Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined from Tallahassee by Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hello, Zach.
And joining me from Pembroke Pines is Palm Beach Post Politics editor Antonio Finns. Hey, Antonio.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning. Well, Labor Day is the starting gun for the final two-month sprint of the presidential race, and both campaigns came out of the holiday weekend with their focus on Florida. Trump held an event in Jupiter Tuesday while Kamala Harris is visiting Miami today. We'll discuss the jockeying for Florida votes, a new poll that shows the race tied in Florida, and some warning signs for Biden in Miami. But first, we'll know what that music means. So John, do you have a number for us today?
I sure do, Zach. My number, I'm treading into the decimal places again. My number this week is 2.7.
2.7. All right. How about you, Antonio?
Yeah, and I am psyched about this number. I've been holding on to it for 3 months. Since May, that number is 16.
16. All right. Antonio with a well-seasoned number since May. And my number is 12,115. Remember those numbers, folks. Write them down. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. President Donald Trump kicked off the final stretch of his campaign with an event in Jupiter Tuesday, where he signed an executive order banning oil drilling off the coast of Florida, or actually extending the ban for another decade. Trump went further and declared himself, quote, the number one environmental president since Teddy Roosevelt. That sent fact checkers into a frenzy. Antonio, you covered the event. How significant is this executive order he signed, and what can you say about his environmental record overall?
Well, yeah, Zach, the executive order is very important. And it not only extended the ban on Gulf of Mexico drilling, but it also expanded it to the Atlantic coastline in Florida and then added offshore Georgia and South Carolina. You know, let's remember, this year marks the 10th anniversary of that disastrous Deepwater Horizon's oil spill. In addition to the lives lost and the explosion on that BP oil drilling platform, the resulting spill damage and impacted as many as 68,000 square miles of Florida, of Gulf waters and coastline, and cost about $62 billion overall to clean it up. The spill is estimated to have been close to 5 million barrels of oil, and it went on for 5 months from April 20 of 2010 until September of 19th of that year. Now, so, you know, the bipartisan goal since then has been to prevent a repeat of that disaster that was so devastating and tragic. And for that reason, this ban is extremely popular and important in coastal areas, and especially for Florida's all-important shoreline ecology and tourism industry. As for President Trump's assessment of his own environmental record, well, you know, that is far less, you know, there's far less agreement about that, and it's far less popular. In Jupiter, you know, the president did tout his administration's achievements for us here in Florida. That included $500 million in more money for improvements to the Herbert Hoover Dike that rings Lake Okeechobee. The president also said his administration had procured $100 million to fight red tide and toxic algae. That, you know, red tide is something that you guys in Sarasota, Zach, are very familiar with. And he said that, you know, there'd been a 55% increase in funding for Everglades restoration efforts. But, see, Democrats raised a lot of other issues, and they raised some very good points here. Democratic rival Joe Biden tweeted that a reminder that Trump back in 2018 announced that he would actually open up both the Atlantic and Pacific waters to offshore drilling. And, Biden's tweet, you know, noted that with 56 days until the election, Trump has, quote unquote, conveniently changed his mind. And, Biden said, you don't have to guess where I stand. I oppose new offshore drilling. So he kind of got his dig in there. But more critical was U.S. Representative Lois Frankel. She's the West Palm Beach congressional Democrat, whose district, by the way, includes Trump's Mar-a-Lago club in residence. You know, and she, first of all, criticized the president for having abandoned the Paris Climate Change Agreement accords. Frankel also chastised Trump for doing little, she said, to prod Republicans in the U.S. Senate to approve Everglades restoration money that the Democratic-led House has already voted in favor of. And she ripped Trump and the administration for not protecting lands. She said that Trump is the only U.S. president in history to have removed more federal lands from protective status than he added. And she was really critical of what she said were Trump administration budget cuts to important federal agencies, from the EPA to the Army Corps. And I have to say, you know, those concerns and critiques have been also expressed by a lot of other people, from environmental groups to scientific organizations. So I think it is fair to conclude that Trump's record does not come close to matching Teddy Roosevelt's when it comes to natural resource protection.
So protecting Florida and all these other states from offshore oil drilling is significant, but you know, the idea of Trump as an environmental president raises a lot of questions there. John, environmental issues are always big in Florida, but they tend to be more of a factor in state races, really. Do you think this the environment will play much of a role in the presidential race in Florida this cycle?
Well, the environment does seem like it's being overwhelmed by, you know, the economy and coronavirus and even criminal justice issues in the presidential race. But it's a subtle dividing line between the Trump and Biden camp, with nobody on the Republican side talking much about climate change, for one thing, and the Biden side clearly embracing at least some of the provisions of the Green New Deal and a commitment to fighting climate change, which is an attention getter in Florida, where we've been getting battered by high intensity hurricanes and coastal flooding. Now, you know, Trump bans offshore oil drilling. That's an easy one, which became a question mark really only when his administration raised the possibility of considering drilling in a second term. Trump has made this kind of play before in Florida when we remember back in late 2017 and into early 2018, during the years when Rick Scott was governor, when Scott was fighting the White House plan to drill, and the White House gave in to Scott just months before he started his successful U.S. Senate run against Democrat Bill Nelson. That kind of gave Scott a victory that he could run on. It looked a lot like political theater all around. This time, Trump seems to be declaring a victory over his own aspirations for oil drilling and somehow using it as a signal that, you know, he is an environmentalist. Now, for Florida, you know, the Trump administration has helped some with funding for the Everglades, rebuilding the dike around Lake Okeechobee. That's another thing that the administration has been generally supportive of. But, you know, even as some of these steps are taken, Trump has, on a larger scale, rolled back environmental regulations from the Obama years. He included in some of those rollbacks were climate change and water policy initiatives. Trump has also opened the Arctic Wildlife Refuge for oil exploration. That's another thing that's completely, antagonizes the environmental community. And he calls climate change a hoax. So that there's not too much reassuring for environmental voters. The Sierra Club's chapter here in Florida said that the money that has come to Florida for the Everglades isn't enough for projects that do always seem to be slow walked in this state. So I think Floridians get a sense with the president, that he's the favorite of the corporate world, and that doesn't often coexist with the kind of tough environmental medicine that we need right now. So I don't know how much this swing through Jupiter really helps sway voters in this state. Calling himself a great environmentalist, well, that's a claim that just doesn't seem plausible, I think, to most voters here.
Yeah, and on the biggest environmental issue, climate change, as you, both of you have mentioned, Trump has taken steps to actually reverse some of the efforts to try and combat climate change, whether it's pulling out of the Paris Accord or getting rid of some of the vehicle emission standards. We see California right now just being consumed by wildfires. You see the sky turn orange there. Obviously, climate change is a huge issue in Florida too, with the state being a fairly a low-lying state surrounded by water on all sides. So we'll see if that factors into the race this year. It does seem like there's it hasn't gotten that much attention with the coronavirus and the economy and some of the racial unrest, but it's certainly an important issue that a lot of voters might take into account. Well, as we head into the heart of the campaign season, the race appears to be tightening here in Florida. Since March, Joe Biden has led in every publicly released poll of Florida voters. But last week, a poll came out that had Trump winning Florida, and another poll came out just Tuesday that had the race tied here in Florida. That NBC News Morris poll had the race at 48-48 between Trump and Biden among likely voters. The Real Clear Politics average of Florida polls now has Biden leading the state by just 1.4 percentage points, down from a high of 8.4 points on July 25th. There's probably many factors that could be contributing to a tighter race here in Florida. The coronavirus pandemic has been ebbing here, and Trump has changed the conversation to the unrest that we've seen in some large cities. But there's also a sense that this was kind of inevitable. Florida's just always close, especially in presidential contests. John, what are your thoughts on what we're seeing with these polls?
Yeah, these seem like the first fall glimmers of what likely will be another race decided by a percentage point in Florida. We seem to have an awful lot of those, including the last three governor's races and the last two presidential contests in the state. So this may not be much different. Whatever it is, Biden's bump in Florida is clearly fading. He had an okay lead, as you pointed out, Zach, in the 5 to 8 percentage range for most of the pandemic, it seemed. But in the last few weeks, that has tightened. And it's really to the point where it's too close to put any confidence in, really, either way. Given the state's history, it seems to me that Florida tends to default Republican. And I wouldn't be surprised if that plays out again. Biden is not doing well with Hispanic voters in Miami-Dade, where Hillary Clinton defeated Trump by 30 percentage points. A poll this week by Ben Dixon and Amandi, a polling outfit that has targeted the Hispanic vote for many years, that showed that Biden has a 17 percentage lead among Miami-Dade voters. That's a big fall off from the 30% level that Clinton had. Why? It's hard to say. Is it tension stemming from the Black Lives Matter movement and policing tactics? A message that the Trump campaign is also trying to use against Biden in the suburbs. But maybe it also works in dense urban areas of great diversity like Miami-Dade. Is it the economy that had been doing what better, of course, until the pandemic? But if Biden slumps in Miami-Dade, that's going to hurt him, especially since it seems that Republicans are strong in getting their vote out across the suburbs, the exurbs, and the more rural areas of the state. The Republicans largely surrender the cities to Democratic voters. We've seen, in our own history in the state, we've seen Rick Scott defeat Alex Sink and Charlie Crist, and the strength of the Republican turnout is what helped drive that. And Governor Ron DeSantis beat Andrew Gillum 2 years ago, helped by, very similarly strong Republican turnout results. This is an unusual political year, obviously. And while we saw Hillary Clinton up on Trump by 7 points at one point in early October in Florida in 2016, Biden is the one Democrat who has does he have a second half strategy for this state? If he is, maybe he's able to bounce back stronger after seeing a small lead erode like we're seeing right now. But it sure does look like he's going to suffer from the same issues that Clinton did, where the campaign began, basking in victory before the race was won.
Yeah, a Democratic strategist, Steve Shale, who ran Obama's Florida campaign in 2008, has a phrase that he uses a lot, and that's Florida's gonna Florida. I mean, the state is just a remarkably close state. I was talking to University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett recently, and he pointed out that over the last six presidential election cycles, the average margin of victory in Florida has been just over 2 percentage points. And that's by far the lowest of any of the 50 states. It's about half of the average margin of victory in Ohio over the last six cycles, and that in Ohio is the second lowest. So Florida, over the last six cycles, has been the closest state consistently. We saw Trump won by 1.2 percentage points. Before that, Obama won by less than a percentage point. And if you look at the governor's races, DeSantis just won in 2018 by less than half of a percentage point, the closest governor's race in Florida history. So it does seem like this is just sort of a natural settling to some degree of the polls in Florida, and that this race was probably always going to be razor thin. As John pointed out, Antonio, you know, one reason that Trump might be improving his status is that he's actually doing better than Hillary Clinton did with Hispanics. And that's pretty interesting. It does seem like the, you know, there hasn't been as much talk about immigration these days in this election cycle, which probably hurt Trump in 2016 in places like Miami. There's also, he's been really trying to court that vote to some degree. I mean, he's been really hammering on socialism. He's gone to Miami to meet with, you know, Cuban Americans. You know, that's been a bigger focus of his campaign, it seems like, this time around. And he does seem to be getting a bigger embrace from Cuban Americans in Miami-Dade than he did in 2016. How big of a concern should that be for Biden?
Well, he should be really concerned, because at this rate, his chances of winning Florida will disappear faster than, if you will permit me, a platter of empanadas and pastelitos at an all-you-can-eat buffet. Biden's problem in Florida, as you guys mentioned, are Hispanics, and most specifically, his problem is among Cuban-American voters, and it's a huge gap. That Ben Dixon Associates poll that John just referenced said Biden trails among Cuban-American voters 68% to 30%. I mean, that is a stunning 38-point gap. You know, why is that the case? Well, first of all, let's remember, you know, Trump did decently well among Cuban-Americans when he beat Hillary Clinton in 2016. And in fact, you know, Republicans generally just do well among Cuban Americans because that is a Republican voting bloc. But in the past 4 years, you know, Trump has made an energetic effort to bolster his standing in Miami. He has mended fences with some Cubans who were turned off by his 2016 primary fights with favorite son Marco Rubio. But more importantly, Trump, as you mentioned, Zach, has really worked to win the loyalty of Cuban Americans in June of 2017 and came to Miami to announce the rollback of President Obama's Cuba policy. More on that in a bit. But also during the Republican National Convention last month, two Cuban Americans, Miami businessman Maximo Alvarez and Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez, got speaking invites. By the way, no Cuban Americans spoke at the Democratic National Convention.
And that's pretty interesting, Antonio. I mean, he really did highlight, you know, of all the Florida speakers, you know, he highlighted Cuban Americans probably the most of any.
He did. He did. And in addition, you know, let's also remember that the vast majority of Cuban Americans work in small and medium-sized businesses, and GOP pledges to always to lower taxes and, just as important, to remove regulations is a major factor that many pundits always overlook. But also, while the Red Scare sort of labeling of Biden as socialist seems a stretch in other places of Florida and to other voters, it does have a grip along Cayuga and a big one. Part of that is rooted in some reality. Remember, Biden served as vice president to Obama, and Obama's Cuba policy is a major factor here. By and large, Cubans did approve of the early parts of Obama's Cuba re-engagement policy. They liked the relaxation of travel to Cuba, for instance, you know, so they could visit family members. But in the eyes of many Cuban Americans, the Obama policy then went off the rails. It just went too far. And in particular, that Obama trip to Havana repulsed lots of voters in Miami. The sight of an American president yucking it up with Raul Castro at the baseball game and that limp wrist hand clasp with the surviving Castro brother was just way too much for people to stomach. You know, when it comes to Cuban communists, the communist government there, Cuban Americans draw a really sharp line between what is practical engagement and what is legitimizing and validating the Castro and post-Castro regime there. And that duality, by the way, hasn't changed in decades. I mean, I remember back in the 1970s during the Carter administration, how a group of Cuban Americans were vilified for having gone to Cuba to seek the release of political prisoners and to start these family visit trips. The process was called el diálogo, or the dialogue. The effort had support until the so-called dialogueros had to sit through a blistering Fidel Castro speech. After that, they were treated as traitors, and when they returned to Florida, their achievements were never really rewarded. You know, and then 40 years later, you guys say that, you know, Donald Trump is capitalizing on that same sentiment. You know, years ago, he embraced the Bay of Pigs veterans group, and it's his hardline segment of the Cuban American community that has the president's ear, not the Cuban American National Foundation that for so many decades was the voice of Cuban Americans on political issues. And I bring this all up to say that the Biden campaign is a real uphill fight here. The question is, as John mentioned, is, you know, what to do about it. I'm hearing from some sources that maybe it's better that Biden drive voter support in Central Florida among, for example, Puerto Ricans, who would be more receptive to a Trump alternative in the wake of both his performance after Hurricane Maria in the Caribbean and the pandemic that has hit the Central Florida job market there especially hard. That is supported, by the way, by a National Association of Latino Elected Officials tracking poll that showed a 41-point advantage for Biden over Trump among Latinos in general. And the key issue the poll found, COVID. Others are saying, no, wait, you know, Biden can still shave enough Cuban-American voters to win Florida. But whatever he does, you know, Biden better do it quickly because Trump has enjoyed the momentum in Florida right now.
Antonio, there's been a lot of talk in recent years that younger Cuban Americans were skewing away from Republicans and more independent and or more towards Democrats, and that that might, you know, shift the Cuban vote, you know, from this reliable Republican bloc to, you know, not so much of an advantage for Republicans. But we're not seeing that in Miami-Dade. You think that's because of the Obama policy or what? Why is that?
Look, I've been hearing that for decades. And in fact, we started hearing that after the Mario boat lift, when there was this supposed division between the Mario refugees and the older 1960s refugees. And, you know, they saw things differently. No, it is still that dividing line. Yeah, younger Cuban Americans are, you know, will differ from their parents and their grandparents. But at the end of the day, it is the idea that many of them also work for small and medium-sized businesses, and they pay attention to taxation and regulation. And then the other issue is it doesn't matter how young you are, it doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter when you arrive. That line between what is practical engagement and what is seen as giving a thumbs up to the regime in Havana is the common denominator among most Cuban Americans.
Well, some pretty interesting developments in the Miami area that could be very significant for the final outcome in Florida. We'll move on to our numbers here. John, you had a 2.7. You want to tell us about that?
I did. 2.7 is $1 billion, and that's what Florida's financial balance sheet for next year is in the negative. Largely because of the impact of the coronavirus on the economy. The $2.7 billion shortfall is projected as part of a three-year financial outlook that the state's Legislative Budget Commission is planning to approve just hours from where we're recording this show on Thursday morning. The Florida Constitution requires that the state adopt a three-year outlook every year, and roughly at this time of the year, mid-September. And this year's numbers are really the grimmest they've been since 2008, when a $3.3 billion negative imbalance was forecast between what the state expects in revenue and what it expects to spend on critical needs. Of course, that was at the height of the Great Recession. In each of the next 2 years, the state's budget is predicted at the current pace to be out of balance by $1.9 billion and then another billion. So that's 3 years in a row, beginning next July, that the budget is going to be out of whack. The red ink eases up a little bit in the two later years, just because the economy is expected to improve some and Medicaid spending should ease a little bit, which, you know, the idea being that families will regain health coverage that they've lost with their jobs during the pandemic. The economists who put these numbers together aren't really in charge of telling legislators how to fix it, but they do offer a fairly limited plate of options, mostly, you know, cutting spending on programs, eliminating tax breaks, or going ahead with tax increases. The so-called revenue enhancements, as they're called in the cold language of economists. The Republican-controlled legislature isn't likely to go ahead with raising taxes, although that was used back in 2008. The taxes on cigarettes and insurance taxes, among them, were increased to try to bring the budget back into balance in that period. But these hard times are going to shape the legislature and Governor Ron DeSantis' future for the next couple of years, including his reelection year of 2022. When you know he's hoping that these budget shortfalls are far behind him somehow.
Yeah, a significant number to follow because it really does affect a lot of aspects of the state, especially education, which, you know, a lot of school districts are struggling right now to, you know, institute health policies and protect people from coronavirus transmissions. And that's been expensive for them to put in all these new precautions. So it could be very difficult if they have to face budget cuts. Antonio, your number is 16. I know you were excited about this number. It's something you've had in your hat for a while. What's it all about?
I do. But gentlemen, first, I have a question for you. Are you ready for some football? Yep. The 2020 football season is kicking off with 16 National Football League games and also a bunch of college gridiron matches. But there's a reason why I'm going to focus on the pro season instead, because this 101st NFL season will be the league's most politically charged season ever. For example, the very fact that the NFL is even kicking off a season is something that President Trump and Governor DeSantis will trumpet. They've made the case, especially DeSantis, that the return of sports this fall is a sign of society moving forward despite the ongoing pandemic. DeSantis has even given the okay for fans to attend Miami Dolphins, Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and Jacksonville Jaguars games, albeit in limited capacities. The governor and the president will point to NFL games as evidence of their success in overcoming the pandemic, and that it signals that indeed COVID-19 is in the past, although, of course, public health officials will broadly disagree. Now, at the same time, President Trump in particular will be dealt a political setback at NFL games. Pro football is in many ways interwoven with the Black Lives Matter protests. Just 4 years ago, remember, San Francisco 49ers star quarterback Colin Kaepernick began a protest that eventually saw players across the country kneel during the national anthem. Trump was outraged by the pregame show of civil disobedience and put enormous pressure on the NFL to stop the protest. Kaepernick was subsequently dropped from NFL rosters, and the league told protesting players to stay in the locker room. In the wake of the killing of George Floyd this year and other high-profile incidents of police killings and shootings of Black Americans across the country, however, things have radically changed. The NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, has admitted the league should have listened to Kaepernick from the start, and the NFL now has embraced the cause of Black Lives Matter. Then there is a drama around the name of one of the NFL's oldest franchises, the former Washington Redskins. That's the team in the city in which Trump resides and where he has so defended relics of the past, including Confederate memorials. Trump has said that removing monuments and symbols is cancel culture. Still, the Washington team finally junked, or shall we say canceled, its name. For decades, Native American groups argued correctly that the term Redskin is a racist slur. The team this season will be called the Washington Football Team, pending a name to be announced later. So when the NFL kicks off this weekend, we will be watching with as much interest what happens on the sidelines before kickoffs as we will watch the action on the field. NFL games won't just be a sign of American renewal from the pandemic, but also a reminder of the racial disparities that exist in our country and a defeat for conservatives in the cultural war. As such, the 2020 NFL season will be a double-edged sword for the president's political messaging. But you know what? For the rest of us guys, it's football, and thank goodness. So, gentlemen, indeed, I am ready for football. Bring it on.
And we got Tom Brady in Tampa. That should be pretty interesting. Definitely going to be one of the most politically charged NFL seasons that we've ever seen. Well, my number is 12,115. That's the number of people who have died of COVID-19 in Florida. That's a lot of deaths, and there are new questions about whether many of them could have been avoided. A new book being published by Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward includes comments from Trump that he played down the threat of the virus to avoid panicking the public, despite knowing that it was a much bigger problem than he was telling people. Trump says on tape that the virus is much worse than even a bad flu, but in public he often compared it to the flu, and that same line was used by many conservatives in Florida to minimize the risk posed by the virus. Expect to hear a lot from Florida Democrats in the final 7 weeks of this campaign about how the president bears responsibility for Florida's high death toll. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Cordy and Joseph Forzano. And thanks to all of you for listening. Stay safe. We're out of here.